Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Always a pleasure to be able to share positive insights with you every day. We're heard all over the world, and I always select the information first based upon its accuracy, coming from a quality source with no bias. We have no politics, no agenda, just quality truths to share with you. For example, what's the one thing we could all do on a regular basis that could absolutely ensure the prevention of most diseases and live a longer life? Simple. Eat more fruits and vegetables. A whole spectrum of them. In fact, the different variety you eat, the different colors you consume, the different fibers they contain, the different phytonutrients and antioxidants, sometimes as many as 100 to 200 different phytonutrients per plant. So at the end of the day, every one of those is protecting your cells from premature damage, therefore keeping your DNA intact and keeping your chromosomes tightly bound by telomeres, and that assures a longer life. Why? Because all the scientific studies show that, including the latest that just last night I submitted the final report after a group of 10 scientists that I don't know, never met, never spoken to, and they send their questions and challenges to a referee who then sends them on to me and says, for peer review, can you qualify this, prove this? And we do, because we had objective blood chemistry from two different laboratories and a university, plus all the subjective improvements. I can sleep better. So I can tell you the one thing that everyone had in common, we really put in the fruits and vegetables. Now, behind that, if you want to live a longer life, exercise every day. Ideally, I believe in the morning for about 45 minutes, in the early evening for about 45 minutes. That's helping you keep your body mass index, your fat, down. It also stimulates muscle. It keeps stimulating the human growth hormone. This keeps you younger longer, and it keeps you cleaner inside. It's not pleasant to talk about, but if you were at an autopsy of the average American, especially when it's average and overweight, which is over 75% of Americans are overweight, and over 65% are obese, and you were to open up the intestine, you would see that the entire intestinal tract is clogged with all types of debris. It's all kinds of fibers that are getting out of the body, bacteria getting out of the body, and a lot of protein, animal protein. In fact, in one case, it was 13 pounds. You heard me right, 13 pounds of impacted feces in one person. The key in life is as you eat a meal, you evacuate the remnants of a previous meal. You keep yourself regular. You keep yourself clean in the intestine. In fact, the health of the intestine is the health of the body. After all, we now know that you have what we considered similar to a neuron of the brain. You have those same things in the intestine. Your immune system really is strongest in the intestine. And then a healthy intestine, a healthy body. So these are just some of the things that we need to discuss and need to do. That said, having a positive disposition, having something worth living for, having a good support group of friends and family also accounts for adding years onto our life. Years ago, as a senior research fellow and director of the anti-aging division of the Institute of Applied Biology, I did a study. The study took about 5 years. And during that 5-year period, I traveled around the world, going to different countries, finding out that people live the same length of time if they live in the city versus the suburbs versus the country. And I found that the longest lived people were in the country. They were the least stressed. They were the most vigorous. They had the most physical activity in a day. Most sat behind a desk. They didn't. They also had a closer relationship with their family and the extended people in their immediate community, in their village. And I met families that had lived in the same house for over 800 years. That's how far back their lineage went. And they had very specific customs, like in Italy, taking the siesta, taking the 2 to 3 hours every day to have a break. And that's where they discussed all the issues of the family. And that's where they would enjoy each other's company. And then they'd take a nap. And this was the way it has been for the millennia, and they are healthiest, most vigorous, have the less kind of diseases. Well, and that was also true at one time in the United States, because when people worked on farms, they lived on a farm, you generally had cleaner water, well water, than in cities that didn't have at that time chlorine to kill a lot of the bacteria and harmful parasites and filtration systems that we would later have. In fact, we've given all the credit for a long life to vaccines. Okay, but then we have taken another more honest and more accurate look and said, well, hold on. People were living very short lifespans. I mean, very short, in their 20s and 30s, in the 17 and 18, 1900s. So what made the difference? Clean water, availability of fresh fruits and vegetables and quality proteins year-round, having central plumbing so that you didn't have to go out into the outhouse. Or in old England, they'd just go in a bucket and throw it outside. And imagine that in the summertime, walking down any street. If you're to do an honest, you know, a look at history, people lived very unsanitary lives. And they just didn't live as we do today. A lot of people never brushed their teeth. A lot of people never bathed. And they ate what they had. You know, so if even if you were the king, you had your own game, but it was brought in. You didn't have refrigerators. You didn't have sinks to wash stuff. Everything was put on the same table and cut up and cooked or grilled. And you had too much protein. As a result, you ended up with what was known today as the royal pain, generally toes becoming very swollen and inflamed. People were in excruciating pain. They couldn't walk. That was due to the lactic acid and the purines and what we call gout. Now, we didn't know that then, but we do today. The more different nutrients you get in, the better it is. The more you walk, the better it is. 10,000 steps, we say today, and that's just the beginning. 10 to 20,000 is much better. Vigorous exercise also. So in the middle of that 10,000 to 20,000 steps, really put the energy in. Really pump those arms and go as fast as you can for about maybe, let's say, quarter mile, and then do it again. So you see, we've learned a lot, and I learned a lot. But the one thing I learned most from my travels is that you could actually create something to a life clock. Now, it's not absolute. It's not exactly precise, but it's a good general reference. Here's how it works. If you work night shift for more than 10 years, you can take up to 10 years off your life. If you smoke, depending upon how much you smoke, how many cigarettes, and how often, and whether you inhale those cigarettes, you can take, again, years off your life. If you, for example, if you are working around or living around any form of electromagnetic pulses, like power lines or antenna, big, the dish, satellite dishes that bring in the signals, you can take years off your life. Drinking, depending upon what the percentage of alcohol is, how often, how much, you can take years off your life. If you're stressed, that takes a lot of years off your life. If it's chronic stress, it's all the time. And you've seen it. I'm sure all of us have at different times been under chronic stress. That disrupts your heart rhythm. That means that your heart is not evenly beating. Boom, ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. Tachycardia, myocardia, these different conditions, AFib. And yet people won't even know they have them. You could have high blood pressure, not know. That's why it's called the silent killer. All because of stress. Yeah, that is the one thing that will prematurely age you more than anything else. So once I put all these things together, what takes off years off a normal lifespan, but then I saw the things that add years to a lifespan, the good news. More fruits and vegetables, more variety, years onto your life. Exercising, years onto your life. And de-stressing, years onto your life. Those three issues alone, exercise, stress management, or at least dealing with the issues that are going to happen to all of us in our transitions and crisis and dramas, as long as you're able not to become personally involved in emoting all the time and deal with meditation and counseling so you can get past this, let it go. In life, ultimately, we have to let everything go. Right now, I'm in a studio. I'm in a beautiful home that I designed and built on a piece of property that was just woods that now is beautiful. It's an animal, a sanctuary. Okay. I also am realistic. The day will come when this will outlive me. Someone else will be in this room. Someone else will be walking the gardens, hopefully appreciating them. The suit that I'm wearing, you know, I buy a lot of my clothes at repurposed stores. I found some of the best clothes from the 1930s and 40s, suits, that Cary Grant look. I like that. I'm 6'2", 170 pounds, all cut, and that's how he looked, and that's, I like that look. You know, I like the 1930s look, and I don't like the boxy look or the real tight, you know, pant look, and I just think they were classier dressers back then, both the men and women. So I go and I'll pick up a suit, $10, $15, $20. I can recut it myself, as I do. I design my own clothes. I go out and buy the fabric. But again, there will be a time when someone will be wearing this, hopefully. I give my clothes away at the end of the year, especially those I've like gone around the country lecturing on television a lot. So it gives me a chance to go out and buy more clothes. Not clothes, but buy more. I don't go out and buy clothes. I go out and buy fabric. And then I take it to the cutting board, cut down my patterns based upon my best-fitting shirts and pants. And now I have something that's made in the USA. Everyone made a living wage from it. And I don't overdo it. And then when I'm finished, I give it as a gift, almost always to the people in this audience. Think of over the years how often people have come once a year to my office and all the clothes are lined up, the shirts, the pants, the suits, everything. And they're all nice and they take them home. If you got a gift, you give a gift. You pass everything forward. Think of Socrates. He passed knowledge forward. Eurycles, Plato, they pass it forward. And as people do today, as your parents did to you, hopefully the right information. So you see, everything adds to or takes away from the years you're going to live. Everything will add to a disease or take away and prevent a disease. And about 95% of all diseases can be prevented. But then we have ways of interdicting within a disease, let's say high blood pressure. And in fact, someone that most of you know, very well-known personality, asked for my help. And when I saw the medications, I said, my God, three medications for lowering blood pressure? But then the person had acute renal failure, acute kidney failure, and the side effects of the medications, renal failure. I spoke with a doctor and I said, doctor, did you talk with the patient about the renal kidney failure, that you were causing the death of her kidneys so you could lower the blood pressure? And she says, you never talked about diet, sodium intake? Well, I thought I did. No. Now that person's blood pressure is almost normal and off all those medications. Yeah, we can make a difference. But we, those of us who are properly and fully credentialed academically, who have all of our licenses, who are engaged in clinical experience, working one-on-one with individuals, and all of us who are still scientists doing quality clinical work and publishing in peer-reviewed journals, we are not considered to be a proper source. Isn't that ironic? So those who claim to have all the knowledge and all the wisdom and not to be challenged by anyone, and then there's this small little group over here, traditional Chinese medicine. I have a friend. This friend came by and had incredible hiccups. Couldn't stop all day, couldn't eat, would vomit. And I would watch him 4, 5, 10 times during the day, would be bent over, gagging. Had a hard time breathing. It's really serious. Went to the doctor, nothing could be done. Went to a different doctor, nothing could be done. Went to an acupuncturist that I know, a medical doctor from China, and one treatment for 30 minutes with acupuncture, hiccups gone, right? And yet, with the thousands and thousands of studies published in the peer-reviewed journal supporting Ayurvedic medicine, that's Indian medicine, and traditional Chinese medicine, acupuncture, for example, chiropractic, none of that is considered legitimate. And that's unfortunate, because it is legitimate. And it's in the National Library of Medicine's peer review system. Those are the studies I use. So when you add and subtract, suddenly you will sit there and go, oh my goodness, I didn't realize what I was doing negative, being sedentary and not getting up and moving my muscles every 2 hours and overreacting to things I shouldn't overreact to and acting out. I didn't realize that was increasing my rate of heart disease and attack and stroke. I didn't realize I was eating all this extra calories. I didn't realize toxins, pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, chemicals in my diet collect and harbor in my fat. Therefore, the more overweight I am, the more toxic I am. I wasn't aware. I thought it was normal not to have a bowel movement maybe every 2 to 3 days. I didn't feel good. I felt grumpy. I didn't know. It should be far more regular, even on a daily basis. I didn't know. Okay, fair enough. You didn't know, but now you do. And what do you want to do when it comes to using information? A lot of people watch this program, listen to this program, and a small percentage actually engage in it. But even what they engage is not always all of the information, but maybe a little information. What's the problem? What's the difference when people say, I got some issues, and I'm going to try to find a way to resolve them in a good way, and they do it, and they stick with it, and lo and behold, they don't look the same age as their peers, they look younger, their bodies don't look the same, they have muscle, they're healthy, their immune system is strong, they might get the flu and have minor symptoms or no symptoms, same with the cold. And then you start to realize, yeah, there is a huge difference based upon the quality of the choices you make in life. So that just shows you that once I sit with someone and I do this, well, what kind of work you do and are you stressed and how many responsibilities do you have and what do you do in your life that gives you happiness and joy and pleasure and meaning? And then I look at all the, and then you add them up. 10 years here, add up. 10 years there, take off. And then you say with the national, today it's about 70. Our average age span has come down to about 74 for men and 75 for women. That's terrible. What we gained in the last almost 60 years, we've wiped off in 3 years because of COVID. That's how radical the isolation and the choices we made were to our immune system and our life. So then you can help a person go from, let's stop all this, get rid of red meat, that's a big one. Let's get rid of too much estrogen in the diet, that drives cancer, the breast, the prostate, pancreas. You get rid of these. Now let's add in more. So that's why I said one of the most important things you can do is add in fruits and vegetables. The more, the better. The different colors, the better. And this is from the University of Turku, T-U-R-K-U, in Finland. Purple fruits and vegetables can protect against diabetes. That's just one study. And look how important that could be when we have almost 90 million Americans with diabetes diagnosed and treated or with prediabetes who will become diabetic. Turns out you may want to eat far more of the purple grapes. How about purple cabbage, one of the best things you can juice and then drink. It's great for the intestine, great for the stomach, turns off inflammation, clear out throughout your whole gastrointestinal system. How about blueberries? Yes, they contain pigments called antho, A-N-T-H-O, cyanidins, C-Y-A-N-I-N-S, which may help ward off diabetes, according to the University of Turku. And they talked about the purplish tubers, which are potatoes, like purple potatoes, that's terrific, really good for you, tastes good too, are particularly good for your health. Turns out that these pigments that make them purple can reduce the risk of diabetes by acting on energy metabolism, gut microbiota, and inflammation. They're anti-inflammatory. They turn off inflammation around the body. The effect observed in this research was even greater among foods containing anthocyanins, which are acylated, meaning that a chemical alkyl group is added to the sugar molecules of anthocyanins. And these varieties are abundant in foods like purple potatoes, radishes, purple carrots, and purple cabbage. So, something that simple, the color of a fruit or vegetable, can help us not have one of the world's leading conditions and killing conditions. All right? Mulberries are also purplish and have that as well. So, just giving you information, hopefully you will use it. Now, the University of Pittsburgh came up with a study about increasing the vitamin B complex will lower your pancreatic cancer risk. That's correct. University of Pittsburgh researchers have uncovered an association between an increase in the intake of vitamin B6 and choline, C-H-O-L-I-N-E, and a lower risk of cancer of the pancreas. The findings were reported in the current Journal of Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention. They looked at 63,000 men and women and found out that if you have more B2, B6, and B12 with folate, which becomes folic acid, and choline and betaine, B-E-T-A-I-N-E, over a 10-year period, you really reduce your risk by 20% minimum. So why not take a 25 milligram B1, B2, B6, all right, 500 micrograms of B12, and a common vitamin. Under therapy, you would probably take more, but that's a good start. And they found that how it prevents that cancer as well. Something that simple. And also, everything today is about nanoparticles. Something so small you can't see it, but it's got a way of either organizing messages or offering messages once inside your body. But according to Cornell University, as well as the University of Binghamton, the nanoparticles in food coloring may be harmful to your gut microbiome. And that's just one area we feel that they're harmful. You'll see nanoparticles in common food coloring and anti-caking agents, and now they're saying it can damage your gut. That's not good. Specifically, metal oxide particles could be disrupting the health of your intestines. And we're consuming these on a daily basis in the average American diet. That's not good. So just try to go through your cupboard, your refrigerator, and try to look to see if there's a metal oxide nanoparticle, and don't use it, all right? The more natural, clean, and wholesome the diet, the less you're going to get these specific nanoparticles in your body, like titanium dioxide and silicon dioxide. Those are used in food, and they're going to negatively affect your intestine, which then in turn negatively affects your immune system. All right? Simple, but something that helps us if we prevent having it in our bodies. And from Drake University comes a study about being bullied is associated with mental distress and suicide attempts in teens. So I think we should have a national dialogue on this. What to do with the bullying culture, and why do we have a bullying culture, and where does it come from, and who's responsible, and who participates in it, and how can we see it before its symptoms end up hurting someone? It's there, just like addiction. We're a nation that is addicted to so many things, not just gambling and drugs and alcohol. Those are the easy culprits. We're addicted to needing other people to be a part of our lives because we don't feel we're enough to be enough in our own existence. We have a lot of problems with addiction. The addiction to insecurity. No matter what you do, it's not enough. No matter what love someone shares, it's not enough. The moment you stop getting what you thought you needed, suddenly there is no appreciation for what you've gotten up to that point. For example, I'll tell you how simple it is. How many people watching right now have spent an inordinate amount of time doing things for someone, and then one day you just decide, you know, they can do this on their own now, and they get angry with you for no longer being responsible for what they should have been responsible for a long time ago, as if everything you did for them no longer counted, or it wasn't important at the beginning, middle, or end. And now they're angry at you for not continuing. That's just enabling people. That's not helping them. So we have to have a whole national dialogue on bullying and our addiction to saving people, or addiction to being saved, mastering our story, but never getting beyond it, staying stuck in that hole, even though everyone and everyone, its friends are there to pull us out of the hole, and we say, help me, save me, and then we just kept letting go of their hands because we've identified more with the hole than we have with saving ourselves. There's an old concept of this, that think of the people who would rather walk around an oasis in the desert, embracing the scars of their remorse, than just take a step onto the oasis and have the fruit, the water, and the environment to survive. That's a lot of people. How you identify. If you identify as a victim, every single thing you see and do, you're going to see yourself as a victim in that in some way. You'll use it against other people, even your friends and family. Well, we're into that big time. So we needed a conversation on bullying because it didn't happen in a vacuum. Now, we've always had bullying, but it's just generally been individuals. And those individuals were not appreciated by the rest of society. And other people who could stop the bullying did so. It's not happening today. This was published in the journal PLOS One. And so I'll be doing programs on it. I'm going to be doing a documentary. I'm finishing up my current documentary. We're in post-production. I'll be coming back to New York to premiere it probably in the next 6 weeks. Now, from the university in Finland, sustained aerobic exercise increases adult neurogenesis in the brains, meaning that you increase the neuron reserve of the hippocampus and thus improve preconditions of learning by promoting neurogenesis through a sustained aerobic exercise, like jogging, power walking, running. And that's very important because it actually gives a positive effect upon the brain's structure and function. For example, the generation of neurons, which is called neurogenesis, in the hippocampus, a brain structure important to learning. And now we see that the more exercise, the more you help your brain. You keep it younger. You keep it healthier. You keep your capacity to think and do critical intellectual chores better. All right? So, just that simple exercise. And finally, a positive attitude about aging reduces the risk of dementia in older adults. Yale University. Research has shown that older persons who have acquired positive beliefs about old age, but from their surrounding culture, are less likely to develop dementia. And yet, just think of how we deal with aging today. We fear it. We don't talk about it. Yet every time you look around, you're seeing someone who's been surgically enhanced or had, you know, a multi-billion dollar industry of making our skin look better or hair from falling out. And it's a big deal. But we're not doing the right things that could really slow down and reverse the aging process, add years onto our life. Why? Because it takes an effort. That's the latest on health and healing and even some thoughts about life itself. I'm Gary Enall. We're going to take a break. And some people just like to listen to health and nutrition and fine. And you can watch this over PRN.live. But then we have a whole lot more program to go with a lot of new insights. I think you'll appreciate what's coming at you. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Sorry, I have an animal sanctuary. An animal that shouldn't have been out was out and harmless, but I just had to put it back in where it belongs.
I know how frustrating it must be for most of you to see so many of our institutions no longer serving our interest, and then seeing institutions we never heard about before, like the World Economic Forum and the Atlantic Council, etc., suddenly deciding they knew about what is best for all of us in every part of our life. Well, fortunately, we have people fighting back, pushing back. And one of them is Professor Jordan Peterson, a well-known University of Toronto professor, also on the faculty of Harvard, very outstanding reputation, until he began to challenge the orthodoxy. And then, boy, everything went against him. They've done everything humanly possible to take away his license, to practice his clinical his profession. However, he's also going against the World Economic Forum. He has some very good ideas of how we can right this faltering ship. He's being interviewed by Joe Rogan. Let's see what he has to say about the fight against him, which is very formidable, and yet he is still keeping a positive disposition and saying what we can do to fight back against this global hegemony invading our rights. Now to Jordan Peterson.
I set up an international consortium based in London. I can't tell you all the details yet, but we're trying to put together something like an alternative vision of the future, say an alternative to that kind of apocalyptic narrative that's being put forward, at least implicitly, by organizations like the WEF, you know, and that's the virginal planet, rapacious tyrant, you know, all-devouring consumer religion. And it's more like something like, well, we want to ask people six key questions. Okay, so how do we get energy and resources at the lowest possible cost as rapidly as possible to the largest number of people around the world? That's one question. And so there's a presumption in the question, and here's one of the presumptions. You don't get to save the planet by making energy prices so expensive that no one poor can afford them. That's off the table. So if you want to develop alternative energy sources, no problem. You know, because, hey, man, the more energy sources we have, the better. But you don't get to impose your utopian vision in the service of your narcissism on the poor. We're going to try to make the poor rich, kind of try to alleviate absolute poverty. Pro-human view on environmental stewardship front. That's the next question. What are the major problems that are confronting us? How do we take a sophisticated, multidimensional view of that? How do we prioritize our attempts to establish our states and our international relationships properly so that we prioritize human well-being, you know, in harmony with nature to the degree that's possible, but human-focused and not predicated on the idea that there are too many goddamn mouths on the planet to feed and that you're evil if you just think about having children. So then on the governance front, this is where it gets kind of more left-wing, I would say, is none of the people involved in this consortium so far are very thrilled with global corporate fascist government media and corporation collusion, you know, and we're seeing this at the high end. It's like a Tower of Babel, is that the powerful players in the world are increasingly collaborating to impose a top-down vision of the future on everyone. And that's a future that's predicated on a zero-growth model. And the idea that, well, we'd need five planets, really, to support everyone at the current standard of living that obtains in the West. So the best pathway forward is to deny loans by the World Bank to developing countries so they can't develop, you know, energy sources, which all that'll mean is they're going to burn wood and coal, obviously. So that's the third question is, you know, how do we arrange systems of governance to stop the march of something like pathological gigantism? This is why I like people like Russell Brand and also you to some degree politically, you know, because you guys are very, what would you say, sensitive to the danger of that kind of corrupt collusion, that regulatory capture that occurs when corporate entities and media entities and governmental entities are all in bed together, like the FDA and the CDC and so forth and so on without end. So that's the third question. The fourth question is, what do we put forward as a vision on the family policy front to facilitate the, what would you call it, the encouragement and the maintenance of long-term monogamous couples who are child-centered and to make increasing the birth rate part of that policy, to put policies in place that would support long-term stable monogamous families, two-parent families, and child-centered. You know, because in the West, because we're very immature, we think that the purpose of a marriage is the happiness of the people who are involved in the marriage, the husband and the wife. And that's just not the purpose of marriage at all. The purpose is long-term facilitation of their psychological and spiritual development and the establishment of an environment that's beneficial to children. That's a responsible way of thinking about it. And so we need to have a serious conversation about what that means. You know, it's tricky because, like, I think the ideal has to be long-term committed monogamous heterosexual relationships. And I had a big conversation about this with Dave Rubin. You know, Rubin's gay and he's married and him and his partner now have two infants. And we talked through how that was. It was a very hard thing for them to arrange, obviously. Why? Well, they're both male. So that poses a severe problem on the reproductive front, right? And so they manage that. They have two infants, but it's very complex. And it's obviously not a solution to the problem of relationship and reproduction that's duplicatable across large numbers of people. It just takes too many resources. Now, I do think we have to have an ideal at the center of every concept. But the ideal can't be too rigid, you know, because people aren't perfect. You know, in my own family, there's lots of people who are divorced. Lots of people, in lots of people's families, there are people who are gay. You know, there are lots of people in unhappy marriages. Nobody attains the ideal. So the ideal has to be surrounded by a fringe of tolerance, but that doesn't mean you sacrifice the ideal. And the ideal has to be, well, we know there's a literature on fatherlessness. You know, it's a bloody catastrophe, fatherlessness, for obvious reasons. You know, human children are complicated. You think you can, maybe if you struggle madly as a single parent, you could do a decent job, and lots of single parents do, but you're asking a lot, you know, for a woman to work 50 hours a week and then spend another 40 hours with her kids and to do both of those optimally with no help. You know, and we know perfectly well that when women get divorced, especially if they have kids, they tend to fall down the economic hierarchy. So it's very difficult. So that's another one of the policies. Then another question. We're trying to make these into questions rather than, you know, we have the answer. The other question is, well, it's pretty clear that we have to live inside a story. And one story is power rules everything. But that's not a very good story. It's a very pathological story. It's more like a confession, too, if that's the story you insist upon. It's like, so you think power governs everything, do you? Okay, I know what you're like. So that's what you truly believe. See, I believe the spirit of voluntary play governs everything, not the spirit of power. It's like voluntary association. That's what we're doing in this conversation. You know, we're playing towards an end, and we're doing it voluntarily, and we're taking everybody along for the ride. No one's forced to do it. So that's the other thing. No compulsion here. It's got to be invitational. And so we're trying to work out what the story has to be. And on that front, I just finished a seminar in Miami, and the first 8 parts of it were released on the Daily Wire 3 months ago, Exodus Seminar. We walked through the story of Exodus. Exodus means exodos, means the way forward. So it's the archetypal narrative of progression from tyranny and chaos into the future. That's what the story is. And we did half of it, released it on the Daily Wire, 8 episodes, 2 hours long. And we just recorded the last 8 sessions 2 weeks ago, and that was an absolute blast. I really, stellar people participating. Man, I learned so much. I learned so much. It's going to take me like 2 years to digest it. But the Daily Wire is going to release it all on YouTube for free, starting in 2 months, 1 episode a week for 16 weeks, and then we're going to keep it on YouTube and the Daily Wire for free for 4 months. And so, and it lays out a vision of appropriate governance as that's an alternative to tyranny and to chaos. So in the Exodus story, so this is very germane to the notion of what might constitute a proper story. So the question that you put forward in your life is something like, what spirit should guide you as you move ahead? And you might say, well, I don't need a spirit to guide me. It's like, yeah, you don't have that option. Some spirit guides you. Might be your stomach. You might be a worshiper of the god Priapus, right? He's the god of giant erections. That's what happens if your whole identity is staked on your sexuality. It's like some spirit is going to guide you. That's life. The question is, what is the highest spirit that could guide you? So in the Exodus story, the proposition of the story is the highest spirit that could guide you is the spirit that objects to tyranny and that calls the enslaved to freedom. And that's the representation of God in Exodus. So that's what God is in the Exodus story. Now, that's not all that God is in the biblical stories, but that's God in the Exodus story. And so that is the God that, if you abide by that God, then you believe that tyranny is implicitly wrong, even if you tyrannize yourself, and that there's something implicitly virtuous about striving for freedom, especially if you're enslaved. So anyways, that's the voice that speaks to Moses. And the voice tells Moses to tell the Pharaoh, the tyrant, to let his people go. That's that famous line, let my people go. But the line is actually, let my people go so that they may worship me in the desert. Okay, so anyways, God through Moses calls the Israelites out of tyranny and he punishes the tyrant. And so if you believe that fate punishes tyrants, you're already immersed in the Exodus story to some degree. If you believe that tyranny is implicitly wrong, of course, most Americans believe that. Okay, so now the Israelites leave the tyranny. You'd think, hey man, great, freedom, because now you're out of the tyranny. That isn't how life works. This is why people won't drop their tyrannical presuppositions. Because you go out of the tyranny into the desert, not to the promised land. Desert first. And what's the desert? Everyone's lost. No one knows which way to go. Everyone fights. Everyone turns to the worship of false idols. Everyone wants the tyrant to reassert himself. That's the situation we're in the aftermath of the death of God in the West. And so that's really useful to know, because one of the things you might want to know in your life is, why do people cling to their own tyrannical presuppositions? And the answer is, well, at least they're orienting structures, pathological as they might be. If you drop them, you're not redeemed, you're just lost. And the idea that being lost is freedom, that's a preposterous idea. No one lost is free. They're just enveloped in chaos. Okay, so what happens in the Exodus story is, now the Israelites are out in the desert, wandering around for like generations, and they get all fractious and fight and bitch and complain and start worshiping false idols, and they're scrapping with each other. And that's because they have the habits of slaves. They don't know how to govern themselves. And so they ask Moses to sit as a judge. And so he does for, the story's very unclear about this, but for a long time, years and years, morning, dawn till midnight, he's judging the Israelites like mad and adjudicating their squabbles. And imagine what he's doing, eh? If you had to make peace between 1,000 people who were squabbling with their, you know, their wife or their friends or their enemies, you have to render judgment on that. You know, and for judgment to work, the people who are judged have to see the judgment as just, because otherwise you have to impose it by force, right? So until you're good enough at that so you can take responsibility maybe for a wife, and then if you're good enough at that, maybe you can extend that to some kids, and then maybe you can serve your local community, and then maybe you can serve your state, and maybe if you really get good at it, you could serve your nation, right? But you're taking the responsibility, and here's the basic rule. All the responsibility you abdicate will be taken up by tyrants. That's the cardinal rule of social organization. And so we're trying to build out this story that's based on the deepest elements of Western tradition, that's an antidote to the false claim that it's only power that rules, because it's not. That's not right. And there is a model of proper governance in there, this idea of a hierarchical structure of responsibility. It's the proper computational structure. It's not top-down tyranny with fractionated individuals, and it's not utter chaos. It's ordered freedom. And that's what God tells Moses to tell the Pharaoh when he says, "Let my people go. Let my people go, no tyranny, so that they may celebrate me in the desert." It's ordered freedom. And it's the ordered freedom that comes along with being oriented towards the highest possible good. And so we're trying to work all that out now. We're going to have a conference in London, October 31st, November 1st, and November 2nd. We're going to bring about 2,000 people together. That's an invited list. We want to bring in people who are cultural figures and political figures, business figures, and invite them to this discussion. But we want to make that completely public, and we want to open up the organization to broad membership, as broad as possible. And then, you know, if it's a success, then we'll open up the conferences as the years progress to larger and larger numbers of people. But we can't, you know, we don't have the expertise or the wherewithal to manage that first off. But we've got the venue already set up in London. I've got all sorts of people on board in Australia and all through Europe and through the UK and all through the United States, South America. All sorts of people are interested in participating. And so we want to help put forward a vision that's enticing and inviting. It's like, imagine you could have the world you wanted. You know, none of this Malthusian limits to growth nonsense. We get our act together. Everyone can have it, can have enough, and maybe more than enough. There'll be enough educational opportunity for everyone. No one will be scrabbling away in the dirt, burning dung, poisoning themselves. Enough food for everyone.
Now we're going to go to a short clip, because there's one person out there who's really a hero, in my opinion. She was with the Irish government and outspoken and reviled because of it. Now she's with the European Union as a delegate. And here is Claire Daly. Where are the questions about Nord Stream sabotage? It's only a minute long, but no one else is speaking up. She is, just like no one in the media is speaking up, because then you would have to hold someone accountable, and we know who's accountable, but then we're not allowing that information. We're actually accusing Seymour Hersh of inappropriate or dangerous information, so it can't get out there. Wow. Let's hear what he has to say.
Since September, the lack of interest in finding answers to who was behind the Nord Stream gas explosion has been, frankly, astounding. This was an act of sabotage, an act of unrivaled vandalism, economically and environmentally, and not a word. No discussion, no questions. Then along comes Seymour Hersh, the world's most acclaimed, distinguished, living investigative journalist. He produces a detailed claim that the United States executed this explosion with the help of Norway. Planned months before the invasion, a Norwegian Navy P-8 surveillance plane dropped a sonar buoy on the 26th of September, which triggered explosions planted by US Navy Panama City divers 3 months earlier under a NATO exercise, and still nothing. I don't know what happened, but I want to know. This is a man who doesn't make claims lightly, a man with contacts, and I find it frankly jaw-dropping that the EU is not asking questions as to who is responsible for sabotaging the livelihoods of our citizens. I am ashamed to be a European.
Good for you. Good for you. A true honest person. Wow. And that's the exception in governments around the world. I have something today that I'm going to be offering for the first time. And hopefully for those in the audience who really care, you'll pay attention to this. This was based upon 10.5-hour webinar, and it went on all day. And we have now edited that in. Roland Marconi, who's been working with me for over 35 years, we just finished this, just finished it this morning. Jay did a great job on the artwork, our art director. I remember seeing Jay in one of my lectures from 1980 when he was in the audience, because he was sitting right in front of his tall guy, long red curly hair. And then later, about 20 years later, he came into work. He's been working there for almost 20 years. In any case, it is the new documentary, brand new, available now. Two DVDs, that's how long it is, 4 hours and 7 minutes. Rescue and Hope, Detoxification from COVID Vaccines. This is a panel of some of the world's finest experts on what they did. Dr. Robert Malone, he was, the chief developer of the RNA vaccine delivery platform. Dr. Peter Mercola, world's leading cardiologist. Dr. Anna Makashia, MD, PhD, integrative medicine. And Dr. Pierre Corey, founder of the Frontline Doctors. Dr. Paul Merrick, one of the most cited doctors in American history. Three of those, by the way, have three board certifications. Bruce Curtis, and Dr. Henry Grayson, integrative psychotherapist. So this 4 hours long, and it's all about the protocols. If you've never been vaccinated, you better know all the things you should have. In fact, I got a call yesterday from a friend who said, I just got all these symptoms. My mom and I just got all these symptoms. Thank goodness I had all the stuff you recommended in my refrigerator. I went and took it all, and immediately the coughing stopped, blah, blah, blah. I went through all this stuff. The temperature came down. I did the sauna because that person was prepared. You hope that you don't need the life insurance. You hope you don't need the fire insurance or hurricane insurance, but boy, does it help when you've had an accident. So if you've not been vaccinated, this information is absolutely imperative. If you've been vaccinated and are afraid of what's happening in your body or could happen, because of all the unknowns that are rolling out all the time, all the young people having heart attacks. And by the way, McCullough, I heard him just say this morning in Australia, in Brisbane, he said, if you have had myocarditis, don't exercise. But who knew that? So all these young people dying, the soccer players, 1,800% rise in their death. He said, because you're only going to inflame it and make it worse. So if you've had the vaccines and you've had side effects, they've had clinical experience helping to ameliorate or improve those side effects, including diminishing the self-organizing nanoparticles that are causing these blockages in the arteries. Some are 6 feet long. And if you have long COVID, one of the speakers in here had long COVID, almost died, was in the intensive care of a hospital. And they wanted to put her on breathing machine, and instead she had an ambulance take her back to her medical practice. And she did everything she could possibly imagine, and she survived. And now her immune system is strong. But that's a wonderful protocol for people with long COVID. And a lot of people have had long COVID, those who weren't vaccinated, those who were. Remember, you can still get infected again and again and again. It depends upon the variant. But as long as your immune system has got what it needs, you've got a lot of help on your side. That is what is emerging that we need to know. And every one of the people, all these doctors, they all were practicing intervention at the very first sign, at the very beginning of COVID. And with their own patients, they said, look, I can deal with this person's infection in the lung. I do deal with that all the time. And so they did. The person didn't need to go and get intubated in a hospital. And all the other conditions you can think of. They used the FDA-approved drugs, about 28 different drugs, including nutrients like vitamin D3 and vitamin C, zinc, selenium, quercetin, etc. So you have the cumulative experience of all these doctors and all the people they've helped. So if this is not the most important video I've ever done, I don't know what is, because this information can make a difference. And you all should be prepared for anything that happens. By the way, no one mentioned shortwave radio. I'd asked that question earlier. Did anyone know the answer of what can happen if your telephone does go? In any case, be prepared. Have it all there. So when you need it, you got it. All right? So I want you to call in. The DVD is called Rescue and Hope, Detoxifying from COVID Vaccines. And it's, you know, it's something that I think everyone should have. If you're not going to use it yourself, then give it to someone who would use it and would benefit from it. That's my hope. All right, we're out of time. Let me give you, first of all, I'll give you the number to call the Vitamin Closet where Neil is, 646-926-5430. That's 646-926-5430. Or you can go online and you can order it yourself. It'll be shipped out today, or you can call and speak with either Sandy or Diane or Neil at 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. I remember when I did the webinar, we couldn't get any more bandwidth. It was expanded as much as we could, and a lot of people couldn't get on. And I told them, don't worry, I'll be doing a documentary from whatever we get. I didn't know it was going to last 10 and a half hours. That's a long time, nonstop, 9 hours, and 90% of the people are still on. So now you got the best of that. And I intentionally took out all this stuff that's the politics, because that's being covered everywhere on multiple sites, multiple articles. But the help that you need and an understanding of that and how it works for you and the doctors' groups you can go to get it, you know, really customized to your own needs, all that is in there. I couldn't give you a better first aid kit if I tried. We're talking about serious stuff. Be on the other end when I get a call at 2 o'clock in the morning. Gary, what's wrong? I got COVID. Mm-hmm. Okay, don't you have? I don't have anything. Why not? Well, I didn't think I'd ever give it. Okay, and that was a friend. Not prepared. Be prepared. Get this very important four-hour documentary. All right, thank you all for listening. Have a nice day. And Utrecht Lee's coming right at you right after this little bit of music.